This has been a long and crazy week. But here we are on the other side of what feels like a new bright beginning. The road is long and the work is hard, but I'm breathing deeply today, and I hope all of you are too. Today's podcast is the last episode in my first season of Words First, which is an amazing thing to contemplate. When I started this podcast as a pandemic project, I wanted to have creative conversations, but didn't really think beyond perhaps getting 10 of these under my belt. With this one, it will be 20 full-length episodes and 2 bonus episodes, a total of 27 interviews, and I've loved every second of it. Season 2 will start up in January of 2021, and I already have some fun things planned and a few interviews in the bag. Today's final interview is with Canadian librettist Anna Chatterton. I was introduced to her when her and Juliet Palmer's opera Sweat, an a cappella piece about the global garment industry, premiered at National Sawdust in 2018. We discuss that, her De Ponte adaptations, Crush and Swoon, and how she's muddled through these last months after COVID put a stop to Moe's Theater. Take a listen. Anna, welcome to Words First. I'm so glad you could sit down and talk with me.
Me too.
So, you're an Ontario... Are you an you're an Ontario-based playwright, librettist, and performer.
That's right.
Did
That's
performing
me.
Come first, or was writing always part of the picture?
Writing was always part of the picture, but I definitely did go to theater school for acting, as I think most people in theater do.
Yes.
And I do continue to act from time to time, but I would say writing is sort of a preferred love.
How did your work in opera come along?
Yeah, that was, I feel, you know, the right place at the right time. I had written a play, a short play that was part of a festival called the Rhubarb Festival that is in Toronto at Buddies and Bad Times Theatre. It's an annual festival.
We've actually talked about the Rhubarb Festival on this podcast before. So that's
so nice. So this is, so I had a play and another playwright turned librettist, Mark Brunel, said to me, he was in my play as an actor, because of course he's also an actor, and he said to me, I'd written a play that was very rhythmic, and it was very, played with literary forms and rhyme, and he said to me, you know, you should apply for Tapestry Opera, has this librettist, this lib lab, they call it, where they hire four composers and four librettists or four writers to do a 10-day boot camp where you basically work with each composer, if you're the writer, and you each make a 5-minute opera. And then you've got 1 day to write it, each one, 2 days for the composer to compose it, and then they have singers on board to rehearse it and perform it for you.
So you're also a LibLab graduate.
I am, yes. Actually, a double one, because then some years later, they did an international LibLab where they brought in some composers and writers internationally. And so then I started working with Scottish, Irish, but lives in Scotland, composer Gareth Williams.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's how it all began. But Mark Brunel said to me, you know, it'll never be the same for you. You'll fall in love with the medium. And he was right.
Yeah, funny how that happens. I think opera it takes us by surprise. I mean, I feel like just from my own journey into opera from theater and dance, I found that it's one of those mediums that you look at from the outside and you think, I don't know. And then as soon as you get into it, you think, okay, well, I'm fine right here. Thank you so much.
So such a moving medium, you know, and it's so rewarding. And I love how I can bring sort of a heightened language to opera, and the audience will accept it, which is very different than the spoken word, right? Where it's harder for the audience to comprehend.
There's also something about the collaborative idea behind opera. Did you find moving into a collaborative form like that to be a hard or an easy transition?
For me, it was very easy because I have co-written 6 plays with another playwright, Evelyn Perry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she was, she just stepped down, but she was the artistic director at Buddy's for the last 5 years.
Okay.
So she and I have been artistic partners in crime for many years. And so, yeah, for me, being collaborative is actually my preferred way of working, because right. I prefer to have two brains on a project, mm-hmm. And to someone to say yay or nay to my offers. And so it was a joy, you know. Of course, it's different in that I'm writing the words and the composer is writing the music, but I like to work with composers that want to collaborate on the story idea together and mm-hmm. go through the arc of the story together. So we know scene by scene. So we know that we're on the same page
sure.
before I begin writing, because the composer, of course, is going to be so invested in it. So I want to make sure that we know and agree on what I'm going to write.
Well, and you can actually, I mean, really look at a composer as being a storyteller as well, just in the fact that their music is driving the plot, is driving the narrative in a different way, but still along with what your words are saying. So it is a very interesting collaboration, I think.
It is. And I learned a lot from the composer. I've worked a lot with composer James Rolfe, Canadian composer James Rolfe. And he talks a lot about how each character should have a different musical framing and phrase. And mm-hmm. I learn a lot from, you know, from those conversations. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm actually someone who's not trained in music at all. I actually longed to have a piano when I was a kid, but my family couldn't afford one. Because right. even though now, ironically, everyone gives them away, but back in the day, it was not the case.
Right.
And so I never had the opportunity to learn music. But I've learned so much from composers over the years. I feel like I really have a more clear understanding of how they create.
Hmm. Just a brief shift for a second. So you mentioned Gareth Williams. So Rocking Horse Winter, you wrote with Gareth. Was that the only piece that was scuttled by COVID? Because you had a performance of that coming up. Or how, I'm just curious, just thinking about, like, you know, as we're all sitting here, you know, writing in our homes.
Oh, no. I have plenty of things canceled by the pandemic, sadly. Uh-huh. Right off the bat, I was 2 weeks away from flying out to Calgary in Alberta, uh-huh. Canada, to start rehearsals for the premiere of a play of mine called Cowgirl Up that I had been working for 4 years
nice.
On. And, you know, 2 weeks before rehearsal, the artistic director called me, Darcy Evans, with great sorrow in his voice to tell me that, you know, they had to cancel the show.
Right, of course.
And that was just the beginning. It was Friday the 13th, ironically.
Of course it was. How perfect.
I know. And then I had another play that was supposed to be done in May in my hometown where I live now, Hamilton, uh-huh. Ontario, a play called Switch that was supposed to be done at Theatre Aquarius and produced by my theatre company here, Industry, mm-hmm. at Theatre Panic. And that was canceled. I had so many things canceled.
Oh, man.
It was a tough season. Yeah, yeah. It was a tough time.
One of the reasons I'm asking is that you had this sort of great quote that I read about losses of your work during this time. You said, nothing can take away from the fact that there are some things that are unrecoverable. And by that, I mean the intangible loss of momentum of your work and the halting of a trajectory of a career. Are you still feeling this? And where do you feel storytelling, either your plays or your operas, is going right now in the wake of all this loss that we're feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel that way. I definitely feel the loss of momentum. And by that, I meant, you know, my play would have gone up in Calgary, for example. Mm-hmm. Other producers were set to come see it. So maybe it would have gotten produced elsewhere. It probably would have gotten published. You know, all this, like, maybe it would have been done other places in the country. Mm-hmm. You know, all this lost momentum that I can't guarantee would have happened, but it was looking likely, you
right.
know. And then somebody sees that play, and maybe then they commission me to write another play. These are all things, you know, things you can't hold on to and say this is a fact, but things that are, you know, what happens when you're at a certain point in career and when your work gets seen to a broader audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to admit that still feels the case, because all the theaters, or not all of them, some of them are slowly starting to look at ways that they can share work with an audience, you mm-hmm. know, safely. But most of them are kind of frozen, you yeah. know, and are in a way unable to think of the future because everything is pending. Right. And so the momentum is pending. In terms of storytelling, I'd say I do have, you know, various grants that Canada is very lucky that we have a big granting system here. So I do have some funding from grants to sort of work on new projects, and it's just in the development phase. Mm. And so I think like this is definitely all we can do at this point is to incubate and generate.
Right.
And so that is what I'm doing. I did, speaking of Gareth Williams, I actually, the other project that he and I were going to work on just before the pandemic hit was with a theater company in Toronto called Theatre Pass Mirai. We were going to workshop, like, or sort of get in a studio at the very beginning of the project and work with two deaf actors and uh-huh. two singers.
Oh, wow.
And two interpreters, and look at how that's possible to tell a story with opera and with sign. And so what actually happened in that case was we had a lot of meetings with we have a deaf collaborator as well, mm-hmm. Jack Volpay, who lives in Montreal, and Catherine McKinnon. She's a co-director with Marjorie Chan, who's the artistic director of Theatre Pass Mirai. And so all of us with two interpreters were on Zoom and we met every couple of weeks for about 4 to 5 months.
Wow.
Discussed it. Then Jack and I started to write. He was writing ASL and I was writing the libretto. Mm-hmm. We took turns writing scenes, and then Gareth is now needs to write music. Uh-huh. So that is something that was able to continue because it was still in the sort of beginning stages. We just weren't able to get in a room
right.
with actors and singers. And so that's what we're waiting on at this point. But I think I think the big question right now is, because of this pandemic, are the stories that we were writing before still resident at the end of this?
It's a huge question right now. Our entire world is coming out on the other side of this changed. So yeah, I think all of us are sitting on this question right now.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And for example, this morning I had this dramaturgy session on my play Switch, one of the ones that was canceled.
Right.
And it happens to be that there's sort of a theme in the play where the characters live in a very fancy house and they're scared to leave. And my dramaturg said to me, this is incredible, because he had been working on it with me before the pandemic. And he was like, not that we have to say this is taking place during a pandemic, and I'm not even saying that we should do that, but the residents, for this idea that it's safer to stay inside and it's scary to go outside, scary to go out to eat, which are things that mm-hmm. the characters say, take on this whole other resonance right now. And you're lucky, because
right.
that is something that we will all feel differently when we can see this play. And I was like, oh, wow, that's a bonus that I had thought of, you know, because I question other pieces of mine. Will the audience want this after, you know, sort yeah. of what's been happening?
Yeah. It's an ongoing question, and I'm curious to see sort of how that goes for everybody as we move into who knows what.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk about some of your past work. Can you actually tell me a little bit about the origins of The Rocking Horse Winner? Where did it premiere, and is it based on the Shirley Jackson story?
It is. Oh, that's very interesting. No, it's based on the D.H. Lawrence short story.
That's, you know what? That's exactly. Yeah. Yes. D.H. Lawrence. That's right.
Yes. Yes.
I'm thinking
yes,
of The
so
Lottery, which is Shirley Jackson.
Ah, absolutely.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it is based on the D.H. Lawrence short story. And huh. Gareth Williams loved that story. And so he actually came to me with the story and said that, you know, he because there's a part in the short story where the house whispers to the protagonist, mm-hmm. the main boy, who's sort of a bit clairvoyant,
yeah.
And is a young boy who can sort of predict who's going to win the horse races. He said to me, that to me means it's an opera, because the whispering can become singing, and it's this magic realism, and I can just absolutely see this opera. Mm-hmm. And so I saw what he meant, and it seemed, I was very taken. There's a mother in the story who is a very unusual female protagonist, particularly of the day of mm-hmm. D.H. Lawrence, where she is a mother that does not feel connected to her children.
Hmm.
And so she feels quite cold. Like, she feels this coldness between her and her son. And I'm a mother, and of course, I do not feel a coldness between me and my daughter, but I can understand it, you know, because being a mother is a very intense experience. Mm. And I really gravitated towards that. And so it was this wonderful character that D.H. Lawrence drew, and then I was able to expand on that. Yeah, so we sort of just see a lot of sort of contemporary choices that we could make that would lend itself to a contemporary audience, because that's always a question you have to ask.
Yes.
When you're, you know, when you're adapting a classic to, you know, an old piece to now, is why now? And so we made this young boy, the young boy of the story, Paul, mm-hmm. into a young adult. So he was in his early 20s, who's autistic. Well, and we never said that. We just said to ourselves, he's on the spectrum, and we never use those words, spectrum or autism, in the play, in the opera.
Right.
But we allude to it, mm-hmm. About how he's different and how he has to be careful and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But that to us helped us make it a contemporary story.
Do you like adapting? Do you like adapting existing works?
I love it. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love it. I wish I could do it all the time, because what's so incredible about it is that, as I sort of said to you about the mother character, is you have these usually very well drawn out characters that have already been figured out, and a structure for uh-huh. the piece. The story has been worked out. All the kinks have been worked out already, and some language, you know, to play with. And, you know, you can borrow from the dialogue or not, and embellish, change, and expand or subtract. But the point is that you're working with something that has already sort of tested its legs as a story.
Yeah.
And so then I can, you know, gleefully sort of run with it.
Right.
Yeah. And I always feel like it's sort of like this very interesting collaboration with someone who is dead, the past writer. You know, if they are dead, indeed. I mean, so far I've adapted work for people who aren't alive anymore.
Gotcha.
And it's a sort of this wonderful dance where I feel like I start to understand them as writers, uh-huh. because you go to this very deep place as a writer. And so I sort of feel like I'm playing with them, because I'm using some of their text. I'm adding to it. I wonder what they would think about my additions, subtractions, what I take away, what I choose to use, what I choose not to use, that sort of thing. Yeah.
So, speaking of collaboration, can you then talk to me a little bit about Crush, which this is another composer you mentioned earlier, that you James uh-huh. Rolfe, that you wrote with James Rolfe at the Canadian Opera Company, I think, Banff?
That's right. Yeah. So the Canadian Opera Company commissioned us to write Crush. It was actually originally called Donna, and then Rufus Wainwright wrote a opera called Donna something, I forget, Prima Donna, maybe something like that. But they were like, you can't call it Donna. And I was like, perfect, because I've actually been harboring this secret word that I would love to call it Crush. Yeah. And that was sort of based on Mozart and the librettist De Ponte opera's Don Giovanni.
Yep.
And so it was, again, a modern adaptation of that story. And what we did was we made Don Giovanni into a woman, which is why originally it was called Donna. Mm-hmm. And so looked at the piece, you know, what happens if it's a female protagonist? Because Don Giovanni, Don Juan, that's such a, you know, classic character. Yeah. What happens if it's a woman? And what happens if it's now? And where does that kind of desire land mm-hmm. on a contemporary audience if it's a woman? And so that was really fun to play with. That came after we did a loose adaptation of another Mozart opera, Marriage of Figaro, which is like, mm-hmm. yeah, that was Swoon, which that is like a three-act opera. We made it into a one-act. Mm-hmm. So we adapted it. But as a result of the success of that on the Canadian Opera Company, commissioned that one, and then we ended up doing it at the Banff Center for the Arts in Alberta.
Do you think that the story of Crush and the way that you have taken Don Giovanni and turned him into a female character, so much has happened since 2015. Do you think that the story, the way you changed the story, holds up in 5 years later, and sort of all the changes to society that we've seen?
That's a great question, actually, because I thought back to that opera before, and I forgot to say that that was James Rolfe who composed it, as well as Swoon. I actually think that I have grown a lot as a writer, and I feel like I would attack it in a different way now. I feel like at the time, and I learned from watching it too, I feel like at the time I took sort of a harder line with it, maybe because I felt like I gotta give this woman justice. I gotta make it clear that she would do this, you know. Mm. And now just sort of like 5 years later, I just, if I were to have the opportunity to revise it, which I probably won't, you never know.
Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah, who knows what could happen. But yeah, I feel like I would actually have a more complex view. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I would change quite a few things. I'd still make, I'd still keep it that she would, that there would be a female protagonist. But I think I'd be a little bit softer around her.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I'd find more layers for her. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I find that a really interesting thing as an artist looking back on past works, and ones that I like, I totally stand by. Mm-hmm. And then other ones that I question, and I think about where I was at the time artistically and in my life and sort of what I was trying to prove. And this was a two-act opera, and it was my first time writing a two-act opera.
Okay.
And yeah, I just sort of felt like the stakes were higher for some reason. Mm-hmm. I think because Swoon was actually really my first opera that I wrote. And the Canadian Opera Company is a really big company. It's the biggest in Canada. It's in Toronto. Mm-hmm. But because it was my first foray into the opera world, I actually really was quite ignorant about who was what in the opera world. Mm-hmm. And so I think I didn't really realize how big it was that we had gotten that commission. James Rolfe realized it. So he was stressed about that, but I was just stressed about pleasing my composer.
Isn't ignorance bliss?
Ignorance is absolute bliss. So I was just like so honored that he had chosen me to, you know, and pitched me to the Canadian Opera Company as a new writer.
Right.
That I was just like, I gotta, make this work for him. And I wasn't thinking about the fact that this was a really huge opera company the way that I would if I, you know, if it was for Canadian stage or another a big theater company in Canada. And so I feel like I had kind of a freedom there.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I think maybe that's good. I think sometimes we get so in our heads when we do have those nerves and anxiety based on just what we know the situation is that we don't work the same way. It's like there's something about really being able to be yourself, not realizing that, you know, not realizing that somehow you're supposed to be anxious about this. I don't know.
Yes.
I find it's not a bad thing.
No, I think it's why, you know, I think it's why sometimes younger artists take bigger risks.
Sure.
Because they don't know the stakes yet.
Yep.
And they're just sort of bullying their way through and trying things, and they're not established yet. They're not trying to beat their last record. They're not like trying to live up to their name, you know? And I think I was maybe a little too self-conscious. Yeah, it's really interesting.
I wanna talk about another composer that you work with quite a bit, Juliette Palmer. Uh-huh. Let's talk about Stitch, which is an a cappella opera for three women and three sewing machines.
That's correct. Yeah. So I should say that Juliette Palmer is actually the wife of James Rolfe. They're partners.
Fantastic.
And I used to work with them so much that they, you know, go back and forth so much that they called me their household librettist. And they were introduced to me through my work at the Lib Lab, because we do a little showing. So they, you know, I guess they saw my work there, and I feel like that was, you know, again, going back to your original question of how did I get into opera? I feel like I did the Lib Lab, but then James Rolfe and Juliette Palmer saw my work, in progress, and they were just in the time where they had both started an opera just a couple of years earlier, and they were looking for a librettist, and so I sort of fit their aesthetic. Juliette Palmer, yes, so Stitch was one of the first operas that we created together. We created that piece, Juliette and James work very differently. James and I work a lot more traditionally, where we'll discuss the opera together, and then I'll go off and write it, and then he'll compose it. Mm-hmm. With Juliette, we usually work in a studio together with other collaborators, and we usually really collaborate with the singers. And so with Stitch, we were in residence with a theater company in Toronto called the Theater Center, mm-hmm. where they give you space and funding for a couple of years, and they promise that no matter how it happens, that your piece that you're working on will get produced, whether they produce it or somebody else produces it. Mm-hmm. And so we had this freedom of a theater space and singers, and we honestly played for a couple of years. We had an architect we were working with. Yeah, it was really quite something. We had an architect that we were working with, Christy Pearson, mm-hmm. and we had these singers that we were working with, and we played with fabric, and we played with sewing machines, and we just experimented. And so the resulting libretto and music really came out of that experiment. Where we were really, you know, in the room with the sewing machines to the rhythm of it and testing it out. And so it was a very, it was a fusion of, you know, of all artistic voices talking mm-hmm. and discussing it. And then, yeah, but we definitely, you know, Juliet does like to do a cappella quite often. She's very good at it. And she, because also she has a company, Urban Vessel, mm-hmm. that she, is the producer of. And so she knows to make work that is not too expensive, right. can tour easily. Cause that one we brought around the country from Newfoundland to Vancouver, nice. You know, and it's also been in the States. And so, you know, she was intrigued by the idea of just letting the sewing machine be the rhythm.
Do you find that you write words differently moving into an acapella? I mean, this sounds like more of a devised work that you were doing in Stitch, but if you work with Juliet in acapella pieces, does the way that you write change knowing that basically the words themselves comprise the music?
In a sense, yes. I think I'd say, like, I mean, that's, it's maybe in that way, it's a little bit more similar to playwriting, where you know, I know that it's the music is, well, I was going to say the music doesn't necessarily sort of is more of the stronger color than the words ultimately, I think, with opera. Mm-hmm. But that said, they are being sung. So yeah, I think it allows me to be even more rhythmic, would maybe be the best way for me to sure. articulate it, because I know that rhythm is key. And, you know, we don't have drums and we don't have, you know, other instruments to provide that rhythm. And so I'm providing the rhythm
right.
along with the singing.
So did Sweat come out of Stitch? This was yes. a piece you presented at National Sawdust and was also yes. a cappella, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, it absolutely came out of Stitch. Mm-hmm. We actually Soundstreams, a music company in Toronto, commissioned us to make Stitch into a longer piece. And okay. so, of course, we accepted it. And then we started to talk about it, Juliet and I, and we were like, we're kind of over this piece. Like, we wrote this a few years ago. It's been performed a lot. And actually, what we're really interested in now, because that was Stitch was more of a historic piece,
sure.
like where we were looking at the role of seamstresses and, you know, that kind of thing. We were setting it sort of back in time. And we suddenly were like, no, you know, like what we're really interested in right now is sweatshops and what's going on in the world and who makes the clothes that we wear. And so we went to Soundstreams and we were like, do you mind? Can we write a new opera? And they're like, okay, we don't have any more funding for you, but okay. We're like, okay. And so we went more traditional with that one. And I wrote the text and she set it to music, but I guess because it came out of Stitch, we just kind of always kept it that it was just for voices and mm-hmm. not for instruments. Mm-hmm. And in that case, we just had a bigger cast.
What brought you to a place of interest about the work in sweatshops and garment workers? And do you find that it's important to bring political issues into the stories that you tell?
I think it's always different for me. I know for Juliet, for sure, that one came out of her, like Stitch, for example, came out of her because her grandmother was a seamstress and Juliet is a seamstress. I mean, meaning not for other people, but she sews all her own clothes. Her daughter sews all her own clothes. Mm. So she, in fact, I ended up lending her my sewing machine and now it's been 12 years later
oh my gosh.
because I don't really sew. And so she was just very interested in sort of looking at that because she was working with a sewing machine so much. But you know, the sweatshops, I think, as I said, that came out of like this, you know, close examination of people who were making clothes back in the day and when things were made, you know, not in factories. And then the conversation just sort of became more like, wow, look at us. We're wearing these clothes. And I really started to think about, oh, I don't make my own clothes. Mm. And actually, I usually buy secondhand, but sometimes I go to H&M and, you know, fast fashion. I think that I do like to write political pieces. They can be, you know, I'm somebody who will make the personal political. I don't always need it to be issue-based mm-hmm. Because sometimes I find, like, even with the writing of Sweat, I had to be very careful not to be sort of, what's the word, like pedantic, like, or is that the word? Like, I didn't want to like hit the hammer on the, right, on the audience's heads, you know, because it's very easy to get very invested in the politics of the world of sweatshops. It's very upsetting. The more that you do research on it and all the stories and the Triangle Fire, you know, shirt factory in New York, of course that's historic, but all the thing, all the, there was a very similar story that happened in Bangladesh at the time that we were talking about. And so it's very upsetting. And so it's, I have to be very careful as a writer, like a first draft that I did, it felt much more like a lecture.
Than you don't want to be preachy about it.
That's the word I think I was looking for. Thank you. I don't want to be preachy about it. And so for me, you know, for an issue based piece, I love writing pieces that resonate in our times, and you know, that people can go and learn and think, you know, because we really, that was something, like I said, that Who Makes Your Clothes was sort of our logo or whatever, you know, to have them. We even had a part where it was like, we had talked about, like, in the program, like, look at your clothes. You don't probably even know where your clothes were made, and now it's an obsession of mine to see where my clothes are made. It's just right on the tag, right? And so it's really fascinating to see who actually makes them. I challenge you to look at your clothes after this and see, because it's very fascinating.
No, I will. I'm just, it's like, now you've got me thinking, which is, I guess, really exactly the point, right? You know, it's to have people leave and, you know, go home and take off their, you know, fancy dress and try to figure out where it was made.
Yeah. And I think what was really interesting when we were doing the research was to realize that it's not just, I mean, we all know what happens in developing countries, but it's also happening in the States. It's happening in Canada. There are sweatshops everywhere. Yeah. And so we really wanted to make a piece that was like a worldly piece, but that people understood that it wasn't just, it's also in Europe, you know, like it's not just in developing countries, you know, that it's happening now. And that's something that I do find very exciting, like for political work, that people can, it, you know, it makes them think afterwards and maybe change their actions.
Do you think that most of your work with Juliet, because you've done a couple of other pieces with her as well?
Yeah.
Do you find most of it veers into a political place like that?
In a sense, one of the other pieces we wrote previous to After Stitch, but before Sweat, we wrote a piece called Voice Box, which was with singers and two professional boxers. And that piece was maybe less overtly political, like not about sweatshops, but it is a feminist piece, and it's about female boxers, which is, you know, a very different world than male boxers and sort of the dynamics that go in that world. So yeah, I'd say there's always, that is definitely like sort of an underlying theme for us. But some are more overt than others.
Got it. Going forward, what stories are you interested in telling, or what stories do you think opera should be telling? And we've talked a little bit about your philosophy of how to instill some political idea into your work, but what are the stories that you would like to be, what are the ideas that you would like to be putting forward in the future?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know if I've quite thought about it that way. I think, you know, I mean, one of the things that Juliet and I actually have in common, which was maybe harder to find for us in Sweat, but I think we did try, we found some places, is I do think, speaking of the pandemic and everything, humor is very important to me. It's also, you know, for example, important to Juliet. And so I think, you know, I heard something recently. It was an Indigenous writer, a famous Indigenous writer, which of course, right, a Canadian Indigenous writer, of course, whose name I'm forgetting right now. Michael Green, I'll have to get back to you on that one. He wrote a book called Trickster that was just made into a series, a six-part series by my friend Michelle Latimer. And that will give you enough information to go on. Apparently he said that he likes to get people, I'm going to be phrasing him, I'm quoting him terribly, but the gist of it was that he likes to make people laugh and then like stick a knife in them. You know, so that's sort of the audience's experience. And so I love that idea. And I think that that is maybe the kind of story, like that's not particularly a topic or a theme, but I think that that, so I think that's really probably what I'm going to continue to go more and more towards, is continuing to make people laugh, but really turn the knife, because obviously this pandemic is showing us the disparities of our world, oh, yes. how separate our worlds are, you know, like even though people talk about it, it shows how we're all going through the same thing, but we're not, you know,
because I heard a quote the other day that was, we're not all in the same boat, but we are all floating in the same ocean.
Yes, that was exactly it. Yes.
Which I thought was just profound. I thought, well, there it is right there. That's exactly
there it is right there. Yeah. And so I feel like, you know, there's a lot of dark stuff to talk about that I do want to talk to. But I want to do it in a way that is, that sort of draws an audience in and doesn't sort of shut them out, but then really makes them uncomfortable.
Right. Right. I think you've got a good start here. Just looking at the DePonte novel, or I mean the DePonte Mozart operas. In Swoon and in Crush, I think he was genius at making you laugh hysterically and then just stabbing you as hard as he can.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm obsessed with him. I have a book of his libretti.
Yeah.
And I think he was truly an incredible gifted writer. And I think it's really a shame that people always say the Mozart operas, but they never talk about Lorenzo De Ponte, who wrote all those texts.
You can't have one without the other.
Exactly. And so I became very obsessed with him. I just wanted to say that Thomas King is the writer that I'm talking about, and it's actually The Inconvenient Indian, which I felt my friend Michelle Latimer also made a film out of. So just correcting myself.
Great. Do you find that you write differently depending on who it is that you're composing with? Like, do you have certain topics? I mean, I'm noticing this as I'm looking at your work. And so as you're talking about what you're interested in writing, what you're looking forward to writing, do you have composers that you think about when you have an idea? Are there certain ones if I'm writing something like this, this is the composer that I feel like I fit best with? I mean, do your ideas sort of disseminate into collaborators as well?
I would say for sure. Like, I mean, right now, I was writing a play that I actually had first conceived in an opera as an opera, and then I changed it to a play, and then I was like, no, I think it should be a play with music, and then I was like, absolutely, it's James Rolfe. Like, I knew it wasn't sort of a Juliet Palmer kind of style, and I knew that it was sort of more of a James Rolfe style. So I would say, yeah, I do. I can at this point, because I've worked with a couple, like, a handful of composers many times, I sort of know what A, they're interested in,
right?
Because that's super important, and B, sort of their style, what their style could lend to the piece. And then I would also say, because, you know, as I talked about earlier, I am such a collaborative writer that often ideas will come together, or we'll come up with the idea together, or the composer sometimes, you know, as Rocking Horse Winter happened, the composer will come to me with the idea. So I think it kind of goes both ways. And of course, the opera world is really all about the composer. And so usually it's the composer that gets the work, and then they bring along the librettist, unless it's like Edward Atwood. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. The opera world really is all about the composer. And I'm on a mission to, not that I think that the librettist needs to be a bigger deal than the composer, but I think that the best operas come out of a terrific collaborative effort, as opposed to it being led by one or the other. So this is my mission.
Wonderful. I so appreciate it, because I was just going to say, speaking of DePonte, have you heard the like anecdote that DePonte and Mozart lived across from each other when they were writing one of their operas, and they would like yell, you know, because of course they don't have phones, they would just yell out to each other through open windows, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? You know, I love
basically
that.
Had like tin can and string.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, we've got more media now, but more savvy about it. But it's the same thing. Like getting on the phone or getting on Zoom or whatever is the same thing. Or sending an email is the same thing as yelling across the street. What do you think of this?
It totally is. Anna Chatterton, thank you so much for this. This was such a fun conversation, and I'm so happy to learn more about you as a writer.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be on here and to talk to a like-minded person. And, you know, I just so appreciate this podcast.
Yay. Thank you.
Yay. Thank you.
Thank you again to Anna. And thank you to everyone listening for supporting this little project for the past 5 months. If you haven't listened to all of the episodes, I encourage you to go to wordsfirst.buzzsprout.com or wherever you get your podcasts and do it. I've been astounded at the conversations I've had. Also, you can follow me on Instagram under the handle @wordsfirstpodcast. I'll be highlighting the interviews I've done this season on there and putting out some teasers for what we have coming up in January. Until then, it's been a huge pleasure. Thanks for listening. I'm Keturah Stikyan. This podcast was recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. Special thanks to Aurélie Doucet for the colorful logo, Eileen Downey for the theme music, and my husband for keeping the dog quiet. Thanks for listening, and until the next time, stay safe, wear your mask, and keep telling stories.